when they were flying, it was my job to keep track of their checklist. And every plane had a checklist. It had about 14 items on it. And it would start, and we called it horizon time. We called it H time for the time the spacecraft was due to come over the horizon. And it started H minus 50. And at H minus 50, we'd send out a request to the computers to generate the, what we called the look angles. Where do we point the antenna on the airplane? And then at H minus 46, we had to have that in-house, 4 minutes. And at H minus, and then we'd turn around and get it on the teletype to the aircraft. Aircraft actually had two-speed teletype, 60 words a minute and 100 words a minute. And we put that on the teletype.
A teletype is like a talking typewriter. It's a machine with paper in it that used to be driven by a computer and talk to another machine with paper in it at the other end. This was communications in the 1960s.
Actually, it was a paper tape they used to put the code on there. Okay, at H minus 42, the plane had to tell us that they received the look angles. At H minus 36, 36 minutes before they get the signal, they've got to give us a status check on all their equipment. Is it, you know, I mean, if everything was fine, great. If they say, well, we're working on a problem right away, that's an amber condition, that goes from green to amber. And if it wasn't working at all, then it got a red, and then that really got a lot of attention. At H minus 32, we had, we'd get a message from NASA. It would say, we want this plane to monitor these 28 frequencies, or 26 frequencies. That message had to go through 13 people in 2 minutes. Well, how do you solve the problem? Very simple. You print it on three-part paper and spread it out that way. But at H minus 30, 2 minutes later, that had to be on the teletype, or that had to be on the teletype to the airplane. At H minus 28, they had to tell us if they could monitor all of those frequencies. And then we get down to about H minus 20, we had a status check. At H minus 14, we had a status check. And at H minus 10, everything had to be done, because then we turned them over. At that point, we turned them over to network, and they became part of the live Apollo network. Then at H minus 0, they hopefully get the signal. And at H minus 10, they'd lose the signal. And at H minus 14, or H plus 14, I'm sorry, H plus 14, they would have to give us a quick look, an estimate of their quality of their data. That was for one airplane. Try keeping track of five or six airplanes when they're spaced 5, 10, 13, 18 minutes apart. I'll tell you what, a one-armed paper hanger had nothing on me when it came to keeping track of these things. But
Stan, to wrap this up a bit so that we can get more questions
sure.
in, that Stan was in the control center. He was in the room. He was helping control all of these aircraft around the world. Now, my question is, how many stations were there in the total Apollo manned spaceflight network, and how many of them were Arias? What were you in control of?
Okay, there were 11 ground stations, three ships for tracking.
14.
And that 11, oh yeah, and then you had the three deep space network.
17.
Okay, and then you had the 8 Araya. We had 8, but we only used 6 at any one time, but we had the other two ready to go. 25.
So he had 8 out of 25. This gentleman was in charge of one-third of the Apollo manned spaceflight network.
Yeah, it was rather hectic. Yeah.
I have two. Did you work on any other of the NASA space flights, and how has the technology changed over each decade?
Oh, boy.
Short answer.
Okay, quick answer, yes. We worked on, believe it or not, one of the Araya flew for 34 years. And over the lifetime, the planes actually, during Apollo, we were tracking military launches, we were tracking commercial launches, we were doing scientific launches and stuff like that. We just wouldn't use all the airplanes. We'd only use maybe one or two.
How many missions did you work on?
I worked from Apollo 4 through 14. And they announced that during Apollo, somewhere in that period, that they were going to lop off. They were originally supposed to have 20 missions, but they announced they were going to cancel the last three, which meant everything was going to end at 17, Apollo 17. And so, seeing the end of the excitement, I had an opportunity to cross train into another field, which in this case was computers, and so I took it. But yeah, from 4 through 14, which included 11 and 13 and all of that. Next question.
I can't even imagine how many moving parts there would have been, not in just ARIA, but just the rest of the Apollo mission. What was the planning process like to get it all up and running?
You can't even begin to describe it.
Can I just set this up? Good. When Apollo 11 was going on, NASA was launching an Apollo mission every 2 months from Apollo 8. So 8, 9, 10, and 11 were all 2 months, but it's 60 days. That was Stan's window. Tell them about your work window.
We had one office that was set aside, and NASA was always sending out updates for future missions. The next mission up, they would give to us for detail planning. They had already scoped out where we might want to put the planes and stuff like that. But they would give it to us 45 days ahead of time, before launch. And during that time, we had our own staff that would go through with the navigators, and they'd do all the detail planning. Apollo 9, for example, we had overflight, and it was an orbital mission. It never went to the moon. Apollo 9, we had overflight and landing clearances in 31 countries around the world. And all of this paperwork had to be done in this 45-day period. Plus,
including countries that were not necessarily friendly to the United States in those days, but their aircraft had landing rights in 31 countries.
He knows this almost as well as I do. But the idea being that we also had to, we would simulate when an aircraft was supposed to be doing something, we would have a simulation, and simulations are not rehearsals. Simulations, they throw you problems and you got to solve them. And it's practice, but it pays dividends. And we had to do that basically with all eight aircraft, depending on where they were at in the mission. But basically, then about a week before the mission, all the airplanes would leave so their crews could get rested. Now we get down to H0, and the rocket lifts off, and it's gone 10 to 14 days. Okay? Now, as Dr. Halperin pointed out, actually it was from Apollo 7 they were launching every 60 days. What's 8 and 14? What's 45 and 14? It's 59. And so even before the planes were back from the previous mission, the day following the splashdown, I would literally go down, because we had, our people, they weren't clean. They would just have note paper all over the place. I'd put a cardboard box at the end of the console and sweep everything into it. And as far as I know, those boxes are still alive today in the Indiana Jones warehouse. Okay, but basically, my daughter-in-law saw the DVD on Apollo, the most recent Apollo 11, and if you haven't seen it, I highly suggest it. It's beautiful, because when you step into that theater, you're leaving 2019, because everything is in 1969.
I think it's on at IMAX Melbourne. It's called Apollo 11, that's all it's called, and it's just made out of archival footage.
Every frame in that 93-minute movie is original film. It's really, really great. But my daughter-in-law saw that, and she says, "Dad, didn't you realize you were doing something historical at the time?" And my response was, "Yes, we realized that we would make history if we were successful or unsuccessful, but we were so darn busy, we just couldn't appreciate it." I mean, well, let's put it this way. We had a saying in NASA at the time, because we were effectively a NASA subsidiary when we were working with them. There was a saying in NASA at the time that the rocket, you'll have to do the translation yourself, weighed 6.5 million pounds at liftoff. But the rocket didn't lift off until the weight of the paper equaled the weight of the rocket. It was just a big paper mill.
You had a question up the back?
Yeah.
Were you ever on a plane while it was launching?
I'm sorry?
Were you ever flying on a plane on one of the arrives?
I flew on one, but not during the mission, because I had my own job to do on the console. My wife, and she told this to Dr. Halperin, NASA had a special viewing area for the wives of, or for the families of the technicians that worked on the project. And it was about 8 miles from the launch pad, and it was across marsh. It was wet. And she went to see every single one of them. And one was described by a radio announcer, when the shock wave hit him, it's like being hit in the stomach with a baseball bat. Isn't like that at all. Every bone, every organ in your body just vibrates. I mean, just totally vibrates. You could stand next to somebody and holler in their ear and they would never hear you. But the interesting part is they could see the rocket starting to take off, but they could also watch the shockwave come across the water. And so all of a sudden it just hits them. And when it slams, it really does. You just can't believe the sound and the vibration itself. Literally, everything in your body, every bone, every organ, and everything is just vibrating.
Let me set up one more question, and this might inspire some more from the audience. We like to try and inspire more girls into STEM subjects these days. We're far more egalitarian and liberated than we were back in the 60s.
Oh, yeah.
In 1960s USA, any photos you see, they're white American males. And that was just the way it was in those days. But I'm setting up you for a story. You communicated with Carnarvon at one stage.
Yes.
Carnarvon is in Western Australia. So I've got a room full of white American. In fact, everybody basically in communication with the spacecraft in America was a white American male. So, Stan?
I was working one night, and this goes to some of your question. We were tracking a commercial launch out of Cape Kennedy, and it was just before Apollo 7. And as you saw the map, what you didn't see above the map was we had a set of clocks across the map for the time at the plane where the planes were going to be operating from. And so we were there was some delays on the launch, and it was a commercial. I think it was a Comsat satellite. And so it was a minimal crew, just me and a controller and our guy on the teletype. And so he looks at he was a lieutenant colonel. So he looks at the clock over Perth, because we were going to have a couple planes flying out of Perth on that mission. And he said, "Stan, I think the time in Perth is wrong." Well, he says, "It's easy enough to correct, so all you do is, yeah, just press the button, call Carnarvon," because they were on the same time zone. And so he flipped down the switch. It says, "Carnarvon, Araya Control." And the voice that came back was a lady. She was working when Carnarvon had some ladies that were technicians. And she was working, apparently, the overnight, some shift. And so he says, but I could see when that voice came back, his mind stopped, because we had never heard a woman anywhere on the network. I mean, it was really, it was a man's world. But I mean, we'd never heard one. His mind just stopped. And he says, "What time is it there, Zulu?" And it was kind of a pause, and a voice comes back, kind of puzzled, says, "It's 0525 Zulu." Well, Zulu is Greenwich Mean Time. Every station in the world ran on Zulu. So he says, "Well, thank you." She says, "Thank you." And he hung up. I says, "Colonel, you wanted Romeo time, which was local time." I says, "Do you want me to call back?" He says, no, don't do it." But do you know, believe it or not, every sim after that, the sim team always made sure they had a woman on that, because you cannot freeze like that. You've got to have instant response. And so that was our introduction to hearing women on the network. Incidentally, if you go see the
50 years ago, and the Australians showed the Americans, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, I mean, but like I say, Oh, and incidentally, the colonel never lived it down, because periodically, for a couple of years afterward, they say, "Hey, Dave, what time is it in Carnarvon?" And but it was kind of a long-standing joke. He never lived it down.
Questions?
Oh, one other thing. If you see this Apollo 11 movie, in the very first part where they're doing the launch, there is one woman on all those men there. There's one woman that was one of the positions.
That's at the launch center at the Cape. At the Kennedy Space Center, there was one woman at launch control. In Houston, there were none.
Yeah.
Mission control in Houston, there were no women.
And then
question up the back there.
How did you combat problems that you weren't faced with in simulations?
I'm sorry?
How do you combat problems that you might not have come across in simulations? Did you have any problems that you didn't come up
with? Well, I'm trying to think of how to answer that. Let's put it this way. We made it work. For instance, we had one case where an airplane, that big dish antenna in the nose, they'd stow it in the neutral like a bowl. And they had one pin about the size of your finger that they'd pull, and then they could go ahead and steer it. Well, every time they pulled the pin to steer it, the antenna operator would blow a circuit breaker. So they had no control over steering the antenna. They'd let it settle back in, put the pin in, pull it out again. Same thing, it'd blow a circuit breaker. So now he starts changing circuit breakers. Pretty soon the guy's gone through every circuit breaker. Now remember, he's trying to get things done here in a very short period of time. And so, and all we can do at the control center, we can't help him. I mean, he's got this problem he's got to fix. So all of a sudden, he's gone through about every circuit breaker in the plane that he could spare. And he looks up on his desk, on his console, at his position in the airplane, and they'd had fried chicken for lunch, and it was wrapped in tin foil. So he took the tin foil, wrapped it around a pencil, and slammed it in there, and the antenna worked fine. But, no, it was literally, many times, if we had, and believe me, we did cover, actually, we actually, ironically, covered some stuff in Sims that actually happened. That's scary, because we already had a solution. One of the things I always remember, because our planes were not flying when we landed on the moon. They couldn't go that. They were down because they couldn't track anything that distance. And so I had a chance to watch both the landing and the moonwalk at home on a neighbor's television set. Mine was broke. But all I can remember when we landed on the moon was this old Walter Cronkite, who was an ABI, who was a news commentator, and you see him very nicely in the Apollo 11 movie. But he kept saying, incredible, incredible, incredible. And I can honestly say that there is no one word of the English language that describes what it takes to put a man on the moon. I will say this much, though. I had a conversation with a man who's since died, about a 15-minute conversation. I'll have to tell you about that. My boss gave me the nickname, because I was the status position on the console. He gave me the nickname of Stanley Status. And so that's the name I live by. But anyway, back just before Apollo, we were down here 10 years ago, but a question came up from somebody down here, strangely enough, that I knew the one guy could answer it was the guy who would get the signals at the Cape from the various stations around the world and figure out which one went to Houston. So I called him because I knew he could answer it. So I called him, and his daughter answered the phone, and she says, who's calling, please? I says, is Dominic there? He says, yeah. She says, who's calling, please? I says, Stan Anderson from California. And so she says, hey, Dad, there's a Stan Anderson on the phone here, wants to talk to you. And he says, Stan who? And so she says, what was your name again? I says, tell him Stanley Status is calling. So she says, it's Stanley Status. And I could hear in the background, Stanley Status, I haven't worked for him for years. But during that, I haven't talked to him for years. And but anyway, we only had a 15-minute conversation, but in that same period, 15 minutes, he used the same phrase four times. And I'll try and summarize it this way. What does it take to put a man on the moon? Well, when you consider the size of the magnitude of the task that we were given to put a man on the moon and bring him back, when you consider the state of technology at the time, when the only people that had personal communicators were Captain Kirk and the crew of the Starship Enterprise, when you consider the challenges like broken equipment that we had to overcome real time, and this was going on at stations around the world, and then when you consider that we put a man on the moon not one but six times, four words, but we did it. The one thing the movie can't capture is the commitment and the dedication, I mean total commitment and dedication of the people that were working on the project. I mean, there were no steady work hours. My wife likes to say that one mission, which is true, Apollo 5, I worked 22 hours. We had comfortable chairs. But I worked 22 hours, went home, got a couple hours sleep, and came back to work. But it was the total commitment of all of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people to make sure that thing worked. I mean, there was failure as far as we were concerned. Failure was not an option. Now, when you consider that, the Saturn V rocket had 5.6 million parts. 1% of that is 5,600. Any one of those could have gone wrong. So the challenge, that was the challenge to get 99% wasn't 99% being right 99% of the time wasn't going to work. But it was the total commitment and dedication of the people on the project. And we had as he mentioned the term trackers, we had the trackers. We had the trackers around the world that worked at all of these various stations, about 2,400, 2,500 people. And it was their total commitment that they took, because when they had to come up with solutions, as I talked to Mike Dinn, who was the assistant.
Deputy director at Honeysuckle Creek on the day of the Apollo 11 landing.
And he took over as director at Tidbin Billa. I slid over to him during one of our at the 40th anniversary, and I said, Mike, did you have as many problems at Honeysuckle as we did on the Araya that the solutions would never have passed NASA standards and procedures? He says, oh, you got that right, mate, because it was just people did what they had to do to get the job done, so that, because the thing was, the challenge was to bring them, get them up there and bring them back.
And it's come to light over the years, many of the people, all these white American males and others that have confessed over the years, many of them didn't see their children grow up. They were just never at home. So a heavy price was paid by a lot of families. And there were ongoing consequences of that. Amongst the astronaut corps themselves, I think about two-thirds to three-quarters of the Apollo astronauts ended up getting divorced. It's not that they were, they were cheating on their wives. They were married to Apollo.
Yeah, they were married to a rocket.
Married to a rocket.
And we saw that.
There was no other way. That's just the way it was back then. So from a psychological point of view, there was a heavy emotional and psychological price to pay. And many of them later on, as they became older, looked back with some degree of regret that I was never able to go to my kid's soccer game or to my, I didn't see my kids graduate. And that's the way it was.
But, well, along with that, the divorce rate among the civilian technicians at the Cape was absolutely horrendous. But ironically, the divorce rate among the military that we had 300 people, no divorces. You know why? Because the wife had already reconciled themselves the fact that their husband's job came, oh, in this case, and maybe their wife's job, because we did have a few ladies, their job came first. And so they had already reconciled themselves with this separation and commitment to something other than them. But as he pointed, but the civilian technicians at the Cape, their wives weren't used to that. And yeah, it's tough to think that they're married, that their marriage is playing second fiddle to a rocket.
Also, the Australian trackers, like the guy who was on the desk on the day, John Saxon, and he was at the luncheon on Sunday, and I know John quite well. He said he regrets he basically didn't see his kids grow up. And he was working at Honeysuckle Creek in Australia, in Canberra. It was about an hour's drive from home. Let's take a few more questions. Yep.
What do you think about the Mars missions and also the whatever NASA's doing to send probes to another star system, I think?
Yeah, the question was, what did I think about the Mars mission and what NASA's doing? Thanks to the politicians, after Apollo, they let the whole system go to waste. And the Mars mission will come sometime in the future. I know that President Trump has said that he wants to see a man back on the moon in 2024, which happens.
And a woman.
And a woman, yeah, whichever. He wants to see people back on the moon in 2024. You've got Mr. Bezos is working on a moon rocket, and Mr. Musk is working on a moon rocket. You've got a couple other people working on moon rockets, including the government. Personally, I don't think it's going to happen. Because one, you, at least with the Project Apollo, we had all these people, they had one focus and one goal. Here you've got all these different people, they're trying to beat each other. But the one thing they don't have that we had in Apollo was the infrastructure. It was the tracking, it was the ability and the commitment to bring these things together. And that is something that once it's gone, it takes years to rebuild, and I don't think you're going to see it. Will we get there? Yeah, we'll get there. Have no doubt about it. But it'll be interesting to see how they... It's good you can get them there. What are they going to do when it comes back? So I don't know if that answers your question or not, but yeah, I think we'll get there. I'd like to see it. I don't know if I will.
It may take longer than what the folks are saying, because Elon tends to talk in PowerPoint presentations. So we'll have to wait and see what he actually does. Any other questions?
Yeah, up here.
How long in total did the preparation for the mission take, like including the building of all the satellites, the setup of all the ships, the planning? Overall, how long would you say it took?
It depends on the nature of the mission. Generally, of course, the astronauts were training for years. They knew which crew they were going to be on. They knew what the mission was going to be. And so they would go for years. Now that during the space shuttle, even then you were looking at probably the crews were preparing more than a year ahead of time just to go into orbit around the Earth. But again, it depended on, like I say, I had a library that I had to maintain that literally had every mission in various stages to Apollo 17, and we were only on Apollo 8 and 9 and 10. So there was a lot of thinking going on ahead of time. Incidentally, one of the strange things was the lunar rover. I think we're familiar with the lunar. I call it the world's most expensive dune buggy.
My I'll just say for those who don't know, there were 6 landings on the moon. The last 3, 15, 16 and 17, had a little electric car with them. They were able to drive several kilometres from the landing module, and it was called the LRV, the Lunar Module, or the Lunar Roving Vehicle.
Yeah, so the Lunar Rover Module, NASA had wanted to have a means of getting the guys around on the astronauts around on the moon, but they'd actually written off the thought fairly early in the program, because every idea that was presented was they were basing it like on a VW or some small car, and the weight alone would been prohibitive. What's more, they really only had the space they had to carry the vehicle. It had to be able to be collapsed and fit into a cubic area of a pyramid area with a total of 5 feet on the side. So you really had to crunch it down. And it wasn't until, believe it or not, it wasn't until Apollo 11. Two guys, civilians, not related, really related to the space program at all, came up with this idea using off-the-shelf parts and stuff like this. So they managed to get an idea. They had to get somebody with the power to make this happen. So they wound up going to Wernher von Braun, who was the head of the rocket program. And he was so intrigued by it that in a space of 3 missions, which is about, at that point, was about 6 months, by Apollo 15, they'd managed to get that thing and put it back in the program. But it wasn't until Apollo 11 they actually decided to go back and put that back in the program.
They invented an electric car with 4 wheels, carried 2 guys in full space suits that would fold up about 84 different ways. I mean, IKEA had nothing on this. It would fold up into a pyramid that was about 1.5 meters on its side, because that's all the space they had to pack the car into. And when it unfolded, it would probably have gone from about Stan to me with 4 wheels on it, and carry 2 astronauts and batteries and a transmitting antenna and everything.
And a color camera.
And a color TV camera. Yes.
Okay, but it was, like I say, not everybody that worked on Apollo didn't come up with it. There were other people outside the system that had some pretty darn good ideas.